Welcome to Mental Illness in Pop Culture. I'm Scott.
I'm Joe.
This is Liam.
And today we have guest podcaster Diana Mondragon. And welcome.
Hello.
And can you tell us a little bit about yourself and what intrigued you about Ingrid Goes West?
Sure. So I was actually a student here at NIU I finished my bachelor's here and then I came back to do my master's and I graduated from the counseling program, the school counseling emphasis. And Ingrid Goes West, I'm a fan of Aubrey Plaza. I like that she plays kind of darker characters. And when I saw this preview in the movie theater, I actually thought it was going to be more of a comedy. And because like what they show is her showing up at the wedding and pepper spraying the bride's face. And to me, that was kind of like a dark, humorous situation. And I wanted to see more of the movie. And I like the idea that she picks up and kind of goes somewhere else. And they didn't really get into too much in the previous to like why she goes there. But that's kind of what interested me in seeing how that was all going to end for her.
Yeah. So I will say, I thought that this was a good movie for mental health issues, with Ingrid and other characters that I hope we're going to be able to talk about. It also intertwines social media. And I do see it somewhat as dark humor, although, I mean, sometimes it's hard to laugh at the situation.
Yeah.
Joe and Leanne, what were your initial thoughts?
Go ahead, Leanne, since you're remote.
Oh, I was just going to say that I didn't even look at a trailer or a preview. I just jumped right in, and I had heard of the movie. And so I thought it was really interesting. You know, I'm a mom of a teenager, and although the characters in this movie are in their 20s, I personally have never seen a movie with this layer of pop culture, social media in it. I see parts of this behavior, people tracking people, and us old people just do Facebook primarily. And so it's just really, really interesting to see this story built around something that is a major part of people's lives now. So I loved that as a premise to begin with.
Let me say a quick follow-up on that. So, Leanne, interestingly, when I was watching this movie, I was thinking of your daughter, who has just turned 16, because I remember around Christmas, we were just talking about what Christmas gifts we had received, and she was explaining to me the phenomena of a YouTuber. And she's like, you know, I got merch, and it's a thing, and so apparently there are people who are famous just for being on YouTube, kind of like how the Taylor character was famous, a famous Instagram celebrity or something like
that.
Right,
that's exactly right.
Yeah, I didn't look at any trailers either. I only looked on IMDb to see who was in the cast. And watching it, I felt so bad for Ingrid.
Yeah.
I mean, she was just so lost, you know, and I can understand, you know, in the opening scene, I didn't know what was going on. I really thought the film was going to fall in flashback and arrive at the very end with that.
Right. I wondered throughout the whole film.
Right. And, you know, so there was probably about 20, 25 minutes of the film where I thought that maybe this was just an over budget Lifetime movie. and it's funny because every Lifetime movie fan knows exactly what I'm talking about. You know, I thought it was just going to be this, you know, really over the top thing. But really at the end of the day, it was such an interesting examination of obsession. And the union of obsession with social media and this desire to, you know, it's the like culture, you know, it's like she wanted to be liked so much that she was willing to basically risk everything. And when she couldn't get it, that crash was pretty hard. And I mean, I can even understand that, you know, not to that degree, but I can definitely understand where she was coming from.
There are definitely some just super cringe-worthy moments, like when she is at the restaurant and when she's in the store and Taylor's right there. Like, there's just moments that made me so, just, I felt so uncomfortable watching.
I was cringing a little bit, too. I mean, and that's why I was saying about the dark humor. It is kind of funny, but it's cringe funny.
Yeah. She's directing the guy that helped out with the car. Like, oh, get a little bit lower. Get a picture from us, like, lower. Like, making him get on the floor, take a picture of them. That's not what you do.
Yeah, but you got to have that perfect shot. You know, it's going up there and your five followers or your 5 million followers are going to see it. And, you know, it's definitely, it says a lot about how we manufacture image.
Mm-hmm.
And manufacturing image used to be the purview of media and culture industries, right? But now, if you have one of these little machines in your hand, I'm holding up an iPhone, by the way. If you have one of these little machines in your hand, now you are the master of image and manipulating image and projecting a certain guise of oneself, which is probably the hard through line of the film. It's just, this is about how do we project ourselves in relation to both the reality of who we are, of who we all are. Because what's the, I always forget character names. Taylor's character, when when Ingrid goes off on her at the end, it's just like, ooh, that's just ugly. Because, I mean, it was revealing really dark secrets about her, Taylor. So.
Well, and from Taylor's boyfriend, or were they married?
Ezra, I think it was
her husband. I mean, we could dissect him also.
Yeah.
Every character. Nikki, too.
Nikki's a trip.
Oh, wow. But so we hear from Taylor's husband how Taylor wasn't always an Instagram celebrity. She was a wannabe at one time, too. And so there's a little bit of a parallel between her and Ingrid.
And they're so different because he claims to not like the idea of like self-promotion, and that's what she does. She sells stuff on Instagram pretty much just by posting herself with it. So I don't know if I really believe that he didn't believe in self-promotion, though.
It's that yin-yang thing going on, especially with him, because we always like to talk about ourselves in very virtuous ways and don't want to. I think many of us, at least, are skeptical on, you know, exposing our own vanity,
mm-hmm.
you know. And for his character, definitely, especially being a starving artist and wanting to have that guise, you know, on display for everyone else to see, you know, to get called out on it. And Nikki was absolutely right. It's like, you wouldn't be saying this if your stuff was actually hanging in an art gallery. So what's that about, you know?
Yeah.
Well, and it was revealing when Ingrid was first exposed to his art. And she's like, oh, did you do the background?
Yeah.
He's like, no, it's found art, which kind of says to viewers, like, this is bullshit.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just put hashtag squad goals over it, and I said it's art.
Yeah,
it's exactly. Like, you're not Banksy, dude.
Yeah. Even Banksy doesn't self-promote, though, for real. No one knows who that guy is.
Well, and also, by the way, what's his name?
The
husband.
Ezra. Yes.
So Ezra, and he's always got a beer in his hands.
Oh, yeah. She, like, even cuts him off at the first scene.
Yeah. And so I wonder if that's his way of dealing with this cognitive dissonance he's experiencing from the plasticity and inability to be authentic.
So I thought a really interesting character in this movie was Dan, the landlord, and then kind of friend, kind of boyfriend, I don't know. But one of my favorite things about him is that he's a Batman fan, and it's a huge part of his character. and what identity. Do you guys think that was necessary at all?
I wondered about that too, because he made so many references that weren't necessary to the movie or to the dialogue, but he said something about how it's like Arkham Asylum, this is just one big cycle, and then he says to Ingrid, you're supposed to be Catwoman, but you're nothing but a Two-Face. So he was making a lot of references, and it just made me wonder, like, what is the significance of Batman to him and to this story?
I have a theory. Well, Batman is the masked man.
Yeah.
You know, and when he's explaining to Ingrid why he likes Batman over, say, Spider-Man, a part of it is because Batman's just this regular dude. Although, technically, Batman was also an uber millionaire. But with that being said, he's a regular guy. He's not radioactive. He didn't get bit by an insect or anything like that. He's just a guy with a mask that goes around and tries to solve crimes. I think he called him the ultimate detective. And so this notion of always wearing this mask, that there's this two-ness, you know, you have the actual individual, and then you have this other iteration, or this, for lack of better terms, it's probably the most appropriate word, this guise of the individual. And so Batman is literally a guise perpetrated by Bruce Wayne, who is not necessarily as a private person as off the charts as, say, Batman is, which is the exact same thing as pretty much every character in the film, including
Dan. Yeah, so I was
going
to say, is it the intention of the writer to focus so much on that conversation and the character, and they do have that conversation about Batman, because it somehow parallels Ingrid?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. And I, you know, so I think with Ingrid, you know, trying to look at her with a clinical lens, I think that she's really struggling with identity. And, you know, and I am not certain of a diagnosis, but somewhere around the cluster of personality disorders, again, struggling with a sense of identity. And so trying to usurp the other Taylor's identity, and before that, whose ever wedding was at the very beginning where she sprayed the mace. And it's funny because as I'm watching, I keep thinking about single white female and Jennifer Jason Leigh's character. And then halfway through the movie, I think it's Nikki says, "What? That's some kind of single white female shit you got going on there."
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it was. But, you know, I don't know. I felt like, you know, when you add this layer of mental illness that Aubrey Plaza plays Ingrid, but when you add the layer of mental illness to Ingrid's character, it just, for me, that's, I don't want to say that I let her off the hook with the things that she did, because she definitely, trying to blackmail somebody to keep cover is, you know, just foul.
Beat them up.
Yeah, have them beat up and the whole
There's
nine.
There's a little bit
but,
of narcissism going on with the extent to which she doesn't care about her impact of other people in order for her to move forward in social media.
But I can at least I can understand that coming from Ingrid. You know, considering that, you know, she lost her mom, her first internet friendship blew up in her face, clearly, with the way the film begins. And, you know, it seemed to me that she was just alone. She was out there with no one, and she was really desperate for some kind of validation and connection. Whereas Nikki, he was just a sociopath. He was a prick just all day,
yeah.
You know, and there was nothing redeeming about him. At all. He took every opportunity he had to down someone, you know.
Somebody didn't even know.
Yeah. Like, he didn't even know Ingrid, really. But then as soon as he found that one weakness, he exploited it against her for all it was worth. You know, got his ass kicked behind it, but, you know, she could have gone to jail.
Yeah.
As could have Dan.
So let's talk about the idea, So what we know for sure is that Ingrid's mom died, or had just died.
Yes.
And kind of as we've been talking, it's been more like, you know, she's in this grief, or she's lonely, or she's whatever. I don't know that singularly the death of her mom caused her to be presenting at this level. So I would say, I mean, we don't know, and correct me if I'm wrong, but was there any indication at all given in the movie about her relationship with her mom, really, or her childhood?
She said that they were really close, and she said, it feels like I lost my best friend. And I kind of got like a caretaker vibe. Like, it looked like she kind of was the one taking care of her mother in the end. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there's no information about how she was, how Ingrid was before even like her mom got sick or anything.
That would have been nice to have at least seen, you know, 2 or 3 minutes worth of flashback to her relationship with her mother so that the viewer could have gotten, you know, a sense of, I'm remiss to use this particular word, but a sense of normalcy. You know, what was she like before all of these events began to unfold? You know, what was her, you know, I feel like there should be a prequel to this film. Like, you know, Ingrid out east, you know, where we could really get inside that part of the story. Yeah. But, you know, I don't know, some film critic once said that you can only judge what's on the screen, and that's all you got.
Really just feel like we just saw just the middle part of the, like, the backstory. Even what happens afterwards, it just ends so abruptly.
Yeah.
It's just like a small piece of a woman's life that you...
It's like a snapshot.
Yeah.
We're just seeing this, I don't know, how long it takes, a week or a couple weeks?
Yeah, it's a really short time frame for the film.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, you know, there's a slight montage in the beginning before she decides to move west. And then you see these images of her kind of tootling around her apartment before she actually makes a connection with, what's her name?
Taylor.
Thank you. With Taylor. Totally, I forget names. So I, because of that, I felt like there was some time passage. But whether that time passage was a week or a month, I, you know, you can't really necessarily tell. But I don't know if the filmmaker even really cares about, you know, time passage, because it's really about the larger theme and what she's trying to grapple with in this junction of, or this intersection of celebrity, connection, social media, and obsession, and depression for that matter.
Stalking.
She's highly depressed.
And just being impulsive. She spent how much in her inheritance money to go to California, and then she bought that house, and then she... Just
and
handing
then she's
cash
buying,
over.
Yeah, buying Ezra's painting for an outrageous amount. So I'm wondering now, since we brought mom into the conversation, and that money was inherited from her mom, if that wasn't sort of linked, that this best friend connection with her mom, now she's replacing it with the money from her mom by trying to buy these friendships and status. And there must be some time passage at the end for the house, I'll call it, to deteriorate and not have electricity, and she's out of food.
Ants running around.
Yeah.
I was like, ooh, this is nasty.
Chinese food cartons.
That was gross. I want to meet the production designers who set that scene up.
So, but I wonder if that was, you know, her mom's money has run out, and so she has, herself has dilapidated.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's a pretty strong visual image. I mean, you really see where she is. Oddly enough, it kind of, I mean, it didn't explicitly remind me of this, but it reminded me of this scene in Pink Floyd's The Wall, in the second half of the film where
coming up in a later podcast
where he's just completely trashed his hotel room.
Oh, yeah.
He's sitting there in the middle of squalor, you know, trying to do this weird organizing of all the trash around the room. And,
yeah,
you know, as a visual indicator of just exactly where is this character right
like
now.
His mental states.
Yeah.
And so it's also true of Ingrid, I think, that her living conditions represent what's going on inside of her.
Right.
I feel like maybe we should jump to the ending. And I did some minimal looking around on the internet. I found that there are mixed opinions about the ending.
I can see that.
I don't like the ending.
I don't like it either.
The ending made me bananas because she didn't learn anything. Like, she wakes up and she's still like, where's my phone? That's the first thing she asks is, where's my phone? And she gets so happy. The only thing that brings her satisfaction is that she now knows she has a hashtag. And the movie ends with her smiling, looking at her phone and probably looking through everything that's under her hashtag. She doesn't even seem that happy when she sees Dan come in.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm so sorry. I was like, dude, your man showed up for you.
He doesn't
care at all.
Like, why is he still around?
But, you know, that was shocking to me, too. It was like, I kind of wish there was some kind of other repercussion. Because, you know, thinking about audiences and how an audience could walk away from the film, I think, you know, half the audience is going to walk away with, you know, she became successful in the end in terms of, and however she's determining what success means. And the other half of the audience is like, she didn't learn anything. You know, what's that? Yeah. You know, but maybe that's the larger point. Maybe we are living in an era where nothing really matters at the end of the day, as long as you can get that validation through your computer or through your phone. You know,
that's tough. That hurts my soul.
I know, it sucks. It's funny because, you know, I'll post on Facebook. So, like, right now I'm posting, like, my 10 favorite books.
Me too.
And apparently the rule is, the challenge is that you're supposed to just put the name of the book up. And that's it. No explanation. No nothing. You just...
That's bogus.
That's what I said. I was like, you know, that sucks. I want somebody to know why I like this book. And so when I told the guy who invited me to do it, and I told him, and he was like, yeah, I've written your stuff. Great reviews, but you're doing the assignment all wrong. And I was like, yeah, but, you know, I like getting those likes. And really all comes down to, you know, I'm checking my Facebook page every hour to see, did somebody say anything about my review for The Exorcist? And it's like, no, damn it. You know, it's like, and I feel like I'm relatively well-adjusted with social media. But at the same time, I want that validation just as much as the next person does. It's a hard thing to get away from because it's so instantaneous and it can become so viral so quickly, however you want to judge what viral means. Because to me, 20 people is viral.
And I do hope that we can talk about it a little bit, just like the idea of mental health and what social media is doing to our mental health and the likes and the idea of addiction. I think internet addiction might be in the updated DSM-5. And I think that's an interesting... The movie helps shed light on some of that.
Well, yeah. And so, you know, in thinking... And this need for approval and validation, which is... I mean, this is just behaviorism 101 and reinforcement schedules. Mm-hmm. Taken to a new extreme, and I'm like that too. You know, I like it if I can get, once in a while, you know, I run a race and I get like 100 likes. I'm like, oh yeah.
I'll remember that.
But I was
and I post something like a picture of us doing something out somewhere, you know, we're both looking to see, and I'll be like, oh, we're getting traction on that one.
Yeah.
I mean, like, it's constant kind of conversation. And I know, you know, going back to the teenager mentioned at the beginning, and not just her, all of them, it's I mean, constant source of praise. It can also be the opposite, as we've seen many times, but it's somebody else identifying with our moments. Maybe there's a less alone feeling in that. I don't know entirely. Obviously, DSM-5 now knows, but, you know, there's a lot to it, and we all do it. And, you know, Joe is old, just kidding, mm-hmm. and me too, and we're still going back to it. So what does it do in the other generation that has that different different experience with relationships because they've always had some kind of technology, you know, the different level of dependence, I think.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Some of the younger people, maybe this is one of the only ways they're getting any kind of praise or encouragement is through comments and likes and views on their social media.
And it becomes a competition too.
And I know that there is research that essentially there's an inverse relationship between the amount of screen time someone has and their level of happiness, I think. Or, I mean, it's interesting because the more connected people are online, the more isolated people are.
Right.
And you can see that play out in people's houses, you know. You know, when you're sitting down for dinner and everybody has their cell phone out. There's a commercial out right now, and I don't remember who the product is, what the product is, but it's a family sitting around and trying to decide what they're going to have for dinner. And the mom is kind of standing behind the couch, and you've got two kids and a dad that are sitting in an easy chair and on the couch, and everyone's just looking down at their cell phone. And she's like, "What do you want for dinner?" He's like, "I don't care." And she's like, "Fine, Italian it is." And it's like they're all just disconnected. They're yeah. all in the same room, but, you know, they can't even really stop long enough to put their cell phones down to have an actual conversation about what to have for dinner, you know. And it's like, wow, is that, I wonder how many people is that reality for? It's a challenging thing. It's the dark underbelly.
I find it really hard to know. So I'm a single parent, and I find it really hard to know what's inappropriate for their development with this technology in play. And, you know, like, okay, so we don't do cell phones at the supper table if we're there together, which is rare. But we used to, when she was a little bit younger, there was a few hours in the evening that it had to be removed, and we don't do that anymore. And I think it's a really hard thing on how to parent that. We're kind of the first generation of having to. And we really don't know what the ongoing side effects are to this level. And I'm not necessarily talking about physical, but there might be those too. It's a really hard balancing act. Like, what do you do in your household to monitor, maintain, encourage actual human interaction?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question, because we have a 13-year-old, almost 14, and the gaming became a really big issue in the house. And it's hard to tell them no, or to put like really hardcore restrictions on how much time he can spend on the computer or in the middle of a game, because it's not just a game anymore. It's literally he's hanging out with friends.
That's
so
right.
how do you negotiate that as a parent?
It's a blurring.
Yeah, it's a complete blurring of these two very, very different activities. Because, you know, all of us grew up in the 80s and or 90s. I'm not sure how old everyone is, so I'll give benefit of the doubt and give two decades. But all of us grew up in the 80s and the 90s, back when video games weren't connected. You had to just sit, and if you wanted to play video games with your friends, you all went to somebody's house in person, face to face, and sat down and took turns with the joystick, and that was it. But now you can be completely by yourself and playing games with people who are in Europe, in Asia, in Canada, et cetera, et cetera. So that,
and even beyond the gaming, I mean, they're like kind of dating. I mean,
yeah,
my daughter and her boyfriend will FaceTime for an hour a night, and they're really not even talking to each other. a little bit, but that's kind of how they're in the same room when they can't be in the same room.
Yeah, I want to bring back to a couple things. Leanne, there was a show that you introduced me to, I think on Netflix, called Black Mirror.
Yeah.
And there's and each episode is distinct. And so, but there's one episode where this liking and status approval giving happens in real life. So, like, after this podcast, the four of us would, like, all rate each other on the quality of the experience. And that's how people gained status. I mean, and it's exaggerated, but it's almost like that's what's happening.
And
that's a lot of pressure.
That's another thing I didn't like about the ending was that she was Facebook Living what was happening. Her, like, setting up basically herself to commit suicide, and she...
Like it was the true Ingrid.
Yeah.
And it was her brief moment of authenticity.
Mm-hmm. She even said, like, this is the real me. Now you get to see it at least once.
And then when that suddenly becomes trending, I mean, that, and the writers in, I said, in an interview with them, they meant this to be funny, that while she was in a coma or whatever, that she became trending. And so that authenticity was totally lost. And then she went back into the social media validation approval, her identity through how much people like her.
Yeah, wow.
So when I said they meant it to be funny, your face looked kind of shocked.
They meant it to be funny that she would be trending while she was in a coma after a suicide attempt?
That's that dark humor.
Yeah, that might
be. That we were cringing.
Something that people, with that in mind, have you heard about the social credit score?
No.
Apparently in China, they now have social credit scores.
That's like that episode of Black Mirror.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's what got me thinking about it. So it's real. It's like happening. The Chinese instituted in 2014 and are saying that by 2020, it's completely nationwide. So all of China will be monitoring your social behaviors and social actions. So if you, for example, don't pay a bill on time, that could have an impact on whether or not you can buy other things. You know, I'm not going to go too deep into it, but I strongly suggest people do a Google search of China and social credit score, because this is like literally the new thing. And I think it serves well to think about the creation of these scores because of a film like this, you know, where you're really putting on display the damages that can come about from overexposure in social media and that quest for the like.
Well, and one of you were saying, when you combine that with mental health issues, mental illness, that's a deadly combination.
Perfect storm.
Yeah. So I want the three of you to know that I'll be rating you all very highly for this experience
we've had. Thanks, man.
I want to say thank you so much to everyone who listens to Mental Illness and Pop Culture. We are available and can be contacted through a variety of means. They all involve searching for Mental Illness and Pop Culture. So happy that we are now on Spotify. And we are also on Facebook, and you can contact us by email, mentalillnessandpopculture@gmail.com, also on iTunes or Twitter, or your app of choice. Coming up in what we have planned for our next podcast, we're going to take a look at mental health issues related to the Beach Boys.
There's a lot of them.
Are you watching the John Cusack movie?
Yeah.
Love and Mercy. Yeah. Yeah, that's... as well as documentary footage and things that we know about members of the Wilson family.
It'll be interesting. I don't know too much, but I heard about, he did an interview about the making of the movie, and it just seems like Brian Wilson was like fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's, yeah. Brian Wilson is just so much of a genius. And what he did with pop music in the 1960s just laid. I mean, they were in friendly competition with the Beatles. So just in terms of his art alone, that says miles. I mean, what Paul McCartney said, that Pet Sounds is his favorite album of all time. But then, you know, he slowly began to deteriorate and barely made it out of the 60s, let alone definitely barely made it out of the 70s. So there's definitely a lot to talk about with Mr. Wilson.
All right. So thank you, Diana.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And we hope that everybody will tune in again next week.
Sweet.
See ya.
Bye.